Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Sean Baker. Dr. Sean Baker is an orthopedic surgeon and an elite athlete who at the age of 54 is achieving incredible feats of physical stamina and physical strength, breaking records on rowing machines, world records on rowing machines. He's achieved incredible things over the last few years, and much of that he attributes to his carnivore diet. So he comes at the carnivore diet from both the perspective of a doctor as well as the perspective of an athlete. And Sean is somebody whose work and tweets in particular have been highly influential in my journey as a carnivore. I'll first get the bragging out of the way and say that I was a carnivore before Sean, and that I used to tweet about when he would post his food and it would contain some green things, I would tweet and tell him, you know, get on our level and get rid of that green stuff and replace it with more steak. And I'm delighted to see that he's taken my advice, and not just taken the advice, he's also taken it to a whole nother level. He's really brought an incredible clarity into understanding eating meat. And I've been hugely influenced by his approach more than anybody else because of the simplicity of how he approaches it and the straightforward manner in which this health intervention really should be very simple, and how he thinks and talks about food, contrary to pretty much everybody in the diet and fitness industry who's always trying to sell you the magic formula and the magic recipe and the magic ratios. Sean is just out there with one consistent message of you need to eat more meat.
And it's very easy to mock it, and it's very easy to laugh at it, but it's much, much, much more difficult to mock the results, especially when you see Sean and many of the people who have taken his advice on his online community, meetrx.com, where a lot of people from all over the world have joined this journey and have achieved incredible health benefits from it. So I'm really glad to have Sean with us today. In particular, as Sean has recently just become a Bitcoiner, so I'm very delighted that after many years of seeing all the Bitcoin carnivores on Twitter, he's finally one of us. So Sean, welcome to the podcast and welcome to Bitcoin.
Say thank you. That's a very nice introduction. I was thinking we could have an altcoin called Beefcoin. I know you're not a big fan of altcoins, but I think Beefcoin might be the one.
All right. Well, that's the end of this podcast seminar. No, I'm joking. Bitcoin is the beef coin. I think all the beef market has already been cornered by Bitcoiners. So there's we can use that as a nickname for Bitcoin. So first of all, Sean, to the uninitiated, could you give us your pitch for the carnivore diet? Why should we eat meat?
Well, I think, you know, I tend to look at things of the long view. And I think if we look at humans as a species over the entirety of humanity, humans were just better humans when we ate a lot of meat. I mean, there's ample evidence, you know, going back however long you want to say humans have roamed the planet. I mean, if you're an evolutionary theory believer, then you're going to say humans have been around about 3 million years, going back to the early Homo habilis and perhaps into Australopithecines. We know that, you know, Homo erectus, and I'm actually about to interview Mickey Bendor, who just wrote a nice paper on the trophic level of humans, but humans acquired the ability to scavenge, you know, meat initially, and then we began to hunt sometime around 1.5, 2 million years ago, efficiently killing these big animals. We grew this enormous brain, and, you know, I think things were doing well for us from an individual level. We then sort of ran out of our food, so to speak. You know, we kind of, through either hunting or other sort of habitat pressures we put on these animals. And it's pretty clear, you know, I know there's people that think that some comet hit the Earth 12,000 years ago, but really these great megafaunal extinctions occurred without exception wherever humans sort of showed up. When they got into the Pacific Islands, all the animals, Australia particularly, disappeared within a few thousand years. Same thing happened in North America. It happened across Asia, it happened across Europe. So we overate our food supply, basically. And then we were left with small, skinny animals, you know, gazelles, which are much harder to hunt. There's much less fat on those animals. Harder to get energy. And then eventually we sort of, by necessity, you know, developed agriculture at some point, you know, and since that time, and many people don't realize that the human species as a whole on an individual level saw a huge reduction in brain size of about 200 cc's. We saw our stature drop by about 6 inches. Our bones became fragile. Our teeth became weak. And so, I mean, we were just better humans when we had access to better nutrition. I think without a doubt, without exception, meat is better food. It's more nutritious. It's more bioavailable. You know, it is more easily absorbed. And if we look at every species that's ever walked or flown or swam across planet Earth, something like 85 to 90% of them have chosen a carnivorous approach to acquiring their nutrition. Now, there are a lot of herbivores on the planet. You can make a lot of individuals through cheap food, but you don't make robust, healthy individuals. And I think what we see is that while agriculture allowed us to develop civilizations and put these sort of artificial hierarchies in place, it has not done much for individual health. In fact, it's made it much worse. And again, it's nice to reflect upon, you know, where we came from. But what I always do is I look at the results. Like I said, I'm very results driven. And I can just say, you know, in 2021, I can take people and I can put them on a diet that consists of either entirely meat or almost all meat. And almost without exception, their health dramatically improves. And I mean, I think it's as simple as that. You know, I think you can make all the speculations and theories and look into biochemical processes. But at the end of the day, results are what count. Results are what matter. And we've got that in spades. And I demonstrate that, you know, personally, not only with myself, but the people that like you said, that sort of do what I've suggested people do. We see tremendous reversals of different diseases, whether it's diabetes, whether it's mental health disease, whether it's autoimmune disease, gut issues, arthritis, so on and so forth. So it's a very powerful dietary intervention. And I think it's one that, many people would find tremendous benefit in.
People can get lost a little bit in arguing too much about evolutionary history and the history of humans. And it's not very easy to come up with conclusive answers on those things. But ultimately, what I really like about your approach is that, you know, we don't need to speculate about how things were a million years ago. We have a lot of cases around us today where we can look at them. And we have, you know, over the last 100 years, we've seen a lot of tribes and a lot of populations in the world go from eating a meat only or predominantly meat based diet into eating a modern diet. And we've seen the incredible damage it has done to them. So personally, the work of Weston Price has been hugely influential in my transformation to carnivory, because he saw populations of people who were eating purely meat and they were doing great. And then a few hundred kilometers away from them, genetically very similar populations who had access to global markets and were able to secure modern foods were suffering from all of the modern diseases that we take as a normal part of life, which were unheard of for the hunter-gatherers who are only a few hundred kilometers away from them. And if we look around today, yeah, the examples of people who are doing these interventions today, I think is just the most fascinating thing about it. When you start hearing these, you know, there's no other explanation for all of these enormous numbers of N equals to ones that, you know, dismissively scientists would like to say, well, it's just this anecdote, as if somehow that invalidates the experience, as if somehow, you know, scientific thinking is going to always just skip over all of these anecdotes, when in fact, you know, it only takes one anecdote to falsify a theory. We only need the sun to rise from the west once in order for all of our geography to be falsified. It's we can't just say, well, that's an N equals one, and we're just going to go ahead and continue to believe what we believe about astronomy. One falsification, you know, one person who's able to thrive on a diet like this poses a lot of questions about the conventional diet perspective on it. You would expect that with all of these incredible results, you'd expect that doctors and the nutrition establishment and other, and you know, government agencies would be all over this. It's a way to cure people very easily, very cheaply, and without drugs and expensive procedures. How has your experience of this been so far?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddine.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Well, I mean, my experience has been it's worked, and I've shown that over and over again. But as far as, you know, being accepted and embraced, there is a lot of, I guess, dogma that's been layered upon. And I, you know, just going back to the evolutionary, again, you point out that we can't for sure know what people ate a million years ago. I think it's hard to do that. You can speculate. You can for sure know what they didn't eat. You know, we know they did not eat, you know, canola oil. They did not eat processed fast food. So we can just say that's not part of the human diet. But as far as, you know, if we look at the systems in place in the modern healthcare system, I mean, it largely is an arm of the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, medical school curriculums were often designed and paid for by pharmaceutical companies as they've been developed over the years. And so you're really within that system. And so as a physician, you're really kind of working as a subcontractor, you know, knowingly or unknowingly for these pharmaceutical companies. And while it sort of does an okay job for some people that are patients, it does a very good job for the pharmaceutical industry. And so that's where, you know, you have to look at who's benefiting from this system, and it's not necessarily the individual. So yes, there's been a surprising dearth of interest in this outside of, you know, actual patients and a few doctors. And I would be, you know, sort of at fault for not saying that many physicians have been adopting it, but it's not because of, you know, excitement through big organizations. It's because we do have this online community of social media and, you know, through my efforts and some other efforts of just every day showing success after success after success. And then be willing to try to back it up through, you know, studies have actually, you know, actually Harvard University has done a study on this carnivore diet. It hasn't been published yet, but it will be coming out probably this spring or probably this summer. And the results on that are going to be, you know, largely what we've seen, which is a very good result. So there's some other studies. And of course, I'm also fundraising for a study to do this because, you know, the NIH isn't stepping up to do it. You know, it's surprising that there isn't a more interest, but I think there will. I think there will be, as it's hard to deny. And I think it's kind of, you can use the analogy of Bitcoin. You know, the results speak for, you can't deny results. And, you know, you've got this phenomenon. And now you're starting to see the wheels turn. You know, you're seeing the corporations starting to take an interest and put money into Bitcoin, just like you're starting to see more and more people in the health community starting to realize it. You know, and it's starting in this low carb community because they're the ones that are most closely aligned to it. When I was talking about a carnivore diet 4 or 5 years ago, you know, and you were a little, and as you rightly point out, you were there before me. Everybody thought you were completely crazy. And now within the low carbohydrate circles, we're seeing many people say, well, you can go carnivore, it's accepted, or just eat more meat. They're just discovering that this incredible health food, which is just ridiculous that we've, you know, to think that it wasn't, that it ever wasn't, is just, just complete insanity. But we have to erase about, I don't know, 50, 60 years of brainwashing, you know, in several generations. And so that's the task at hand.
Absolutely. I think the parallels are uncanny in terms of the reaction that it elicits from conventional thinkers. So it's the same reaction that you get from economists when you mention Bitcoin. You get the same reaction from nutritionists and doctors when you mention eating meat only. It's that snarky know-it-all, I have a degree, you don't have a degree, shut up. You know, why are you stepping on my turf? Do you know who you're talking to? No, of course you can't just eat meat. No, of course you can't have a money supply that is fixed. No, of course you need a central bank. No, of course you need to have your 6-to-10 ratios of grain every day. And I really think this is part of why there's such an overlap between Bitcoiners and carnivores, because it takes an enormous amount of doggedness and bloody-mindedness to be able to withstand the onslaught of people mocking you for wanting to eat meat or Bitcoin, because, you know, it's not what the science says. And being able to just, you know, tune all of that out and think for yourself and listen to your own body or listen to your own portfolio and make the decision that is best for you and reap the benefits from it. It seems like it's simple, but it's actually extremely difficult. And over the years, I've seen many people who have, you know, people I know who have heard about this for many, many years, and they continue to see the results. And they continue to laugh at it, and they continue to mock it, and they continue to just say, well, this is crazy. You know, in the same breath, they'll tell me, wow, you haven't been aging. What is your secret? Well, my secret is I eat meat. Aha, you're still doing that crazy diet? That's so crazy. And are you still into that crazy digital currency? Well, you know, it's incredible when you think about thinking of the results. It's almost a no-brainer. You know, people who eat like this end up having much better results. And similarly, people who hold Bitcoin end up outperforming all manner of other financial assets consistently for a very long time. But tell us more about what you saw as a doctor. So from your experience as an orthopedic surgeon, these kind of interventions were working, and they were working so well that you weren't allowed to do them anymore.
Yeah. So as I, you know, what got me into this, you know, and as you mentioned, I've been an athlete my whole life. I've been fortunate to be able to compete at very high levels and be very successful. And I, you know, I put the training in, and, you know, I think I was in my early 40s where I noticed that, you know, my health was starting to take a turn for worse. So I started to play with different diets. And initially I did the sort of thing that you know, we've been taught, you know, to cut calories, to eat low fat, to eat lots of vegetables. And I was able to lose weight. I mean, to be fair, I was able to do that through sheer discipline and, you know, coupling that with, you know, increasing the exercise capacity or the exercise I was doing. I was just miserable. I was a miserable, unhappy person that was hungry and tired and grouchy all the time. And I realized it's not something I could do. So I made this transition into different dietary situations. I ended up more eventually on a ketogenic diet, which was kind of heavily meat favored. And I saw a profound difference. And then as a surgeon, you know, I was a very busy surgeon. I'm a very competitive person. I like to compete. And one of the metrics by which surgeons were judged by at the hospital was how many surgeries you were doing. They had a running total. Who did the most surgeries this month? And damn it, almost every month it was me. You know, I was because I hustled. I mean, I didn't take a break. I didn't sit down. I wasn't sitting in the doctor's lines. I was go, 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 go. You know, let's get this stuff done, you know, and good outcomes with the patients. You know, the hospital had me on billboards and radio shows, on magazines, you know, pro bono, because, you know, I was good for their bottom line. You know, this is the way a hospital works. The more procedures you do, particularly when we're talking about surgical subspecialties, the more money the hospital makes. So they love that sort of stuff. So as I sort of, you know, went on my own health journey and found out some things were working with me, we got in a situation where we had a lot of obese patients. Obese patients have higher risk for complications after surgery, whether it's infection or failure of you know, the physical therapy, or, you know, just catastrophic failure for surgery. And so we are very highly encouraged to have patients lose weight prior to big surgeries like joint replacements. And invariably, you almost never had success. You tell your patient, hey, Mrs. Jones, I need you to lose about 50 pounds before you're safe for this surgery. And, you know, they come back 2 months later and they might have lost 5 pounds. And then you'd send them back and say, hey, we keep trying. They come back another 2 months later and now they've gained 10 pounds and they're in your office crying, you know, desperate. And you just kind of say, okay, we've tried everything. We're going to go ahead and do the surgery anyway. And, you know, most of the time they did okay. But as I discovered, you know, these very low carb diets, I started seeing success in a very, you know, predictable way. But more importantly, what was kind of interesting to me is that I had people literally on the schedule. I could look at their x-ray. Yeah, you need a knee replacement. Your knee's worn out. Looks pretty bad. They're in horrible pain. I put them on a low carb ketogenic diet and their pain would go away. And so all of a sudden we're in this situation and often without much weight loss. You know, I could see them back 2 weeks later and they say, hey, doc, my knee doesn't hurt anymore. So that was very curious to me because I was like, wait a minute, well, the reason you're having surgery is because you're having so much pain. Well, as I, you know, kind of to see this over and over again, physician in me said, hey, this is great. You know, I can have these people avoid surgeries. We can do this. And so I wanted to pursue one day a week where I would just do lifestyle, you know, talk to people because it's very difficult. You know, the modern medical practice is, you know, every 15 minutes you're seeing patients. That's on the schedule. The reality is you might be seeing two patients or three patients in that 15-minute block because you're overbooked and there's people that need to come in and you don't want to turn people away. So, you know, you have 6-7 minutes to see a patient. That's not enough time to initiate a diet and go through the, what it takes, you know, what you should be able to do. And so I started asking the administrators at the hospital. Now, and remember, I was the head of the surgical group. I was the lead orthopedic surgeon for the entire group. Hospital. And they basically said that, you know, we really would prefer you just stick to surgery. You know, don't get people better through lifestyle. We like it that you're making a lot of money for us and doing a lot of surgery. And, you know, it eventually I couldn't ethically reconcile myself to ignoring this anymore. And so I kind of did it on my own. I just started saying, you know, telling my scheduler, hey, block me this time. I'm going to spend more time with these patients. And eventually that got me in hot water of the hospital. And then we went through this long, arduous sort of sham peer review process. I ended up leaving the hospital and, you know, and then I just kind of started to start doing lifestyle stuff. And that's where I am now, 5 years later, you know, where we've got this company MeetRx, where we've now, I mean, we've got tens of thousands of people whose lives we've changed, you know, for the better. And I've done more for people, you know, with regard to their health as a guy screaming about eating meat than I ever could as a surgeon. And so it's kind of crazy, but that's why it's kind of worked out.
Yeah, it's absolutely inspiring what you're doing. And it's an incredible testament to just how important diet is and how much more effective prevention is than treatment and intervention. Because, you know, if you can prevent the problem from happening in the first place, if you can take away the cause, that's the root solution to the problem. But unfortunately, that solution doesn't tend to be very profitable. There's not a lot of people that make money from you eating a lot of meat. Sure, meat farmers, cattle farmers make money, but the margins in the meat industry, as you say, are not very huge. And you know, your butcher has very thin margins, and it's not like the industrial food industry where you can produce at mass scale, and you can produce at low cost, and you can then market it and sell enormous quantities of it. So there's a lot of money in the food industry, and there's a lot of money in the treatment industry. There's a lot of money in getting people sick, and a lot of money in treating them. And you know, the hostility toward meat, in my mind, is because it disrupts those two businesses. It disrupts the business of feeding people cheap junk fiat foods that get them sick, and it disrupts the business model of making millions from treating and managing, which is the horrific word that they use, managing illness, which essentially means maximizing how much money you can make out of it. The parallels with Bitcoin are pretty striking in that in Bitcoin, you know, there's an enormous central banking industry and a lot of governments and government related agencies that live off the industry. And Bitcoin just completely disrupts that. It just says, we don't need to have a central bank, and we don't need to have a class of society that is able to influence and control the money supply. We don't need to have a banking system that is entrenched with the central bank and that gets to borrow at favorable rates. We don't need to have this entire central planning business. We can just have software do it. That, in my mind, explains a lot of the hostility that we see.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I think that, you know, the parallels are incredibly striking. You know, you think at the way that, you know, we do have this hospital healthcare system, and I'll go as far than saying disease management. I'm saying disease maintenance at this point, because we're just maintaining people in their states of disease, hopefully prolonging their life so we can continue to capitalize on their need for medications, drugs, and the healthcare system in general. I mean, it's, you know, $3.5 trillion a year direct care spending costs in the United States. And that doesn't even count the indirect costs that go in there. So it's a huge percent of our GDP going into healthcare. Probably 80% of it is unnecessary. And, you know, you can imagine if you just cut out 80% of that, you know, how many businesses would go under, how many hospital systems would collapse, you know, how many pharmaceutical companies, bottom line, would be destroyed. And so you have this ability, and I see the parallel with Bitcoin. You know, you've just got this alternate universe that you can participate in and you can do very well. And I think the same thing, and my hope is that the market will dictate, you know, market will show you that, you know, people prefer to be healthy rather than dependent upon drugs and having their symptoms maintained or managed. And I think this is where we see this parallel, and we see a lot of the same people that have stepped out of one, you know, one system to realize that there's a lot of things that look like that. And we see that with, you know, people that for whatever reason, I think that's why we see so many people that share this, the same sort of thing. The Bitcoin carnivores is a pretty big phenomenon.
Yeah. And the great thing about having you on board is that you really are the poster child for carbohydrate deficiency. Like it's great to have you as the poster go-to reference, because you know people think that, well, if they're a scientist and they know about medicine, you know, they're going to be a dweeb in a lab coat because they're so busy figuring out the right food for you to eat and to design the right diet for you that they're going to look like you know, Dr. Michael Greger and all these vegan MDs. And, you know, you as a carnivore doctor there are just standing and saying, no, actually, if you can figure out the food, you know, it's not something that you need to spend your life in a lab hunched over to try and figure out the secrets to healthy nutrition. If you can figure it out, you should be out there looking like Superman if your diet works. And it's, you know, in the same way that Bitcoin returns are becoming harder and harder for the haters to deny, we're going to see the same kind of thing. Anti-meat nutritionists and the pro, essentially the mainstream nutrition establishment, which is practically junk food advertisement. We're going to see people who do this in the long term. You know, their health is likely going to suffer from it. And it's good to have this kind of visual illustration. My favorite person that makes me optimistic about this is Bill Gates, because, you know, he's out there promoting all of the Frankenfoods and meat substitutes. And he is the perfect poster child for meat deficiency. Look at him. He looks like a sack of rotten potatoes. He looks absolutely terrible. And you wonder, you know, somebody who's worth more than $100 billion, why can't they figure out how to eat so that they could look healthy? It's sad for him, but he genuinely believes. And it's clear, you know, there's a lot of crazy talk about Bill Gates being some evil mastermind. And I think it's far worse than that. It's not. He genuinely clearly believes that eating meat substitutes is good for you. You look at him, he's clearly not getting enough steak in his diet. If he was, he wouldn't be looking like this. So he's not out there as part of some nefarious conspiracy to feed you bug food and feed you soy to destroy you. He's eating it himself very clearly. And, you know, it's sad for him, but it's good that people like him who are promoting this, they look like crap, and they're only going to start looking, they're only going to look crappier over time as they continue to promote this. And I think that gives me hope that people are going to notice. You know, it's the same thing with fiat and Bitcoin, that you know, all those haters, all the people who have so many problems with Bitcoin cannot show you an investment strategy that can beat holding Bitcoin. And similarly, all those people who want you to eat bugs can't show you somebody who broke a world record while eating bugs. And another thing that you bring up, and you've spoken about this on Twitter, is how public health has treated the issue of COVID and the two different approaches. I found this absolutely fascinating. Like you or somebody like PD Manian on Twitter, and pretty much everybody who's into results-focused diet and nutrition had a very non-hysterical reaction to this thing. And the focus was from the beginning on, you know, people should eat well, get sunshine, work out, and that's how you maintain your health. And here we are 1 year of hysteria later, and the studies continuously show that metabolic health and diet were enormously influential in the outcomes of contracting that disease. So I got the coronavirus at some point. I was not feeling well for 2-3 days. My productivity went down about 20% for a week, and I slept about 30% extra for a week. And then I was back to normal, and life goes on. On the other hand, people who are not metabolically healthy have had much worse outcomes. But you don't hear anybody mention that except, you know, crazy fringe people who eat meat like you and me.
Yeah, I mean, I've been profoundly disappointed in the way that this whole pandemic has been handled for a number of reasons. But, you know, I guess just back to the fake meat stuff that Bill Gates and many of people in Silicon Valley are investing heavily in. I mean, they're investing in your, they believe that people are gullible enough. And sadly, many people, they would be right in their assumptions, because we see that. And when we look at these sort of alternative meat products, all that you can use the analogy of the altcoins, I suppose, you know, the Ethereums of the the food world. You know, we've got these. So I did a nice interview with Stefan Van Vliet out of Duke University. He's a researcher looking into food quality. And when they look at beef, for instance, there's something like 55,000 unique compounds that are found in beef. And they compared that directly to these Impossible Burger, Beyond Meat burgers, and they found there was only 10% overlap, even though the nutrition labels were very similar, similar amounts of protein, similar amounts of fat, similar amounts of, you know, iron and these other products that they're able to get in there. But of the 55,000 compounds, and I think they tested 2,000, but of those 2,000, only 10% overlapped. And so even though it may look and smell and taste sort of like meat, it's not meat. It'll never be meat. And the same thing goes with the cell culture stuff. You know, that's because this is the next thing. We're going to grow meat in a lab, and therefore it's going to be better for the environment. First of all, you know, when we look at the inputs to grow lab meat, you have to maintain these giant vats of cellular glop at basically about 98 degrees. It's incredibly energy intensive to do that. You have a huge, you know, heating and air conditioning systems, which require fossil fuels to produce them in the enormous amount, in the billions of pounds of you know, this meat-like product you'd have to do to replace the beef industry. And then the inputs, you can't just grow these things. These cells just don't grow from nothing. You have to feed these cells continuously. And so where do you get the food from? Where do you get the protein from? Well, you get it from soybeans and peas and whatever monocrop that destroys the environment. It's really not at all an environmentally sustainable solution. It's not a energy saving solution. It's just a bunch of marketing smoke and mirrors. But back to the, you know, the coronavirus issue, you know, I've said from the beginning, you know, I think the measures we're taking are cosmetic. I mean, they're band-aids, you know, having people walk around with a mask on, maybe it makes a small, tiny fraction of a difference. You know, a recent study just came out looking at counties. It's on the CDC website. 1% difference in growth rate, you know, of death or incidence rates. 1%. They said it's statistically significant, and that may be, and that's true, but is it clinically significant? If I told you with absolute certainty that I could lower your blood pressure by 1%, would you even care? I mean, it's not even clinically significant. So you have to understand the difference between statistical significance and actual meaningful clinical significance. And so when we compare that to something like obesity, where we know that someone who has a BMI of a certain threshold has got a 200% increased likelihood of dying, or if you increase that even more, a 400%. So we're going 1% versus 400%. Where should our emphasis be? Should we isolate, protect, and improve the vulnerabilities of these populations that are at risk? Or should we just shove everybody in the basement, tell them to hide, wait for a vaccine, which, oh, by the way, we don't even know if it's going to cut down on transmissions or not, has been, you know, in my view, a very backwards way of doing things. I'm not that I'm saying that those things can't have some effect, but we're missing the elephant in the room. We're totally disregarding what we should be doing. And, you know, I think if you look at countries like Japan and Vietnam and other countries where obesity rates are almost non-existent, and you look at their outcomes and you compare it to, you know, the UK, you compare it to the United States, it's not even comparable. And people are saying, well, these people are more compliant. No, they're just not metabolically wrecked when going into this thing. And it's not a surprise. Every single other disease, infectious disease out there, whether it's influenza or another coronavirus or any other thing, we see these people that are metabolically compromised always do worse. And, you know, the interesting thing is that, and this is something that people don't want to see, don't want to talk about because maybe they're afraid of offending people. But if you look at people that are poorly controlled diabetics or obese or have some other similar situation, they basically will spread and shed virus for longer than a medically healthy person. They will shed more virus particles. They will incubate more virulent particles. So when you have a large population of obese people, more you just end up increasing the mortality rates across the board for everybody. So these people that are, you know, saying that, you know, well, you didn't do this, or you're not taking a vaccine or wearing a mask, who's a bigger risk? Is it the person that continues to exist in this state of metabolic compromise? Are they actually putting you at risk? I'm not so concerned about myself because I, you know, I take care of myself. Like we talk about, I get outside in the sun, I exercise, I go outside, I eat well, so on and so forth. And it's not that I'm invulnerable and nothing could ever happen to me. It's not like I'm bulletproof or can't die. But right now, during this little 30-minute discussion we've had so far, I've probably inhaled 50 million virus particles. I mean, this is not even exaggerating. And guess what? I'm still here, just like you are. I mean, there's something like 100 billion viral particles that we ingest every day in our guts. And if we can't handle that, then there's a big problem. And I think and the problem is a lot of people can't. We're seeing where people are becoming so compromised due to the chronic ingestion of what you like to call fiat food. That's a huge part of this.
I found it absolutely amazing how people, get also self-righteous about you needing to wear a mask and you needing to stay home and you needing to shut down your business and keep your kids at home and prevent your five-year-old children from playing with other five-year-old children, even though, you know, the odds of a child dying from this disease were lower than the odds of the child getting hit by lightning over the last year. There was a study, not getting hit by lightning, but dying from lightning, I think, or maybe getting hit by lightning. I can't remember. But yeah, it's absolutely one of the last things that children should be worried about. And then you've had children all over the world basically robbed of a year of their life, robbed of their education, robbed of their normal social development, robbed of their sports, their activities, their milestones, everything that means anything to them. We just had it snatched away and we put them in their homes in front of, you know, Zoom calls and videos and just, don't be selfish and sacrifice your childhood for people who are not willing to sacrifice their Doritos. I mean, it's absolutely insane how self-righteous those people can be about you needing to make sacrifices when somehow this entire idea of the person themselves taking charge of their own health, you know, eating healthy and not eating the garbage food that is making them weak is just not something that gets discussed. And if you make the mistake of watching mainstream media, if you watch CNN and that other kind of brain damage, you will think that way because that stuff doesn't come up. They'll never frame a segment about what you could do to reduce your risk. Stop eating all the junk Doritos full of corn and soy and all of these industrial foods and replace them with actual food and then see what happens to your risk. You know, that doesn't get mentioned. And people just like to think of this as just this virus is just some outside threat that will just attack people and destroy their bodies. And the reality is that's not the case. You have an immune system that can fight these things off and you can improve your chances of fighting that thing off by not spending every day of your life abusing your immune system. But that's just not a message that anybody wants to hear. Kudos to you for continuously rubbing it in people's faces because they need to hear it more often. It's an astonishing degree of irresponsibility that people expect others to sacrifice their lives for them when they are not willing to make the smallest sacrifice of just quitting the junk food that is killing them.
Yeah, the CDC just, you know, because they've now started to recognize, I mean, and they've known this from the beginning, but it's now becoming more widely recognized that, you know, the vast majority that have died, been hospitalized, have been these people that have been, you know, significantly obese, you know, in countries where obesity is a big indicator, 90% of the cases. And so the CDC recently said, what can you do? Well, social distance, wear two masks, wear them real tight, and take a vaccine. Not even a passing comment about lifestyle-related issues. I mean, and I commented on that. I said, look, you know, you could at least passingly mention, you know, you've got this huge platform. This could be the perfect opportunity to say, look, America or, you know, UK or, you know, wherever, you know, Lebanon or where you can take this opportunity now to look in the mirror and say, we need to do something to change this chronic disease issue we have, because that's the real pandemic. It's not even controversial. I cannot, you know, and I haven't watched a lot of TV, but I can't recall one instance where Anthony Fauci has said, hey, guys, just go for a 15-minute walk a day and cut back on the ultra-processed food. It's as simple as that. It's a very simple message. You don't necessarily say, you know, I'm not expecting them to say, everybody go eat a carnivore diet. But at the very least, you could say, and it's not even controversial to say, put down the Doritos, go for a walk. You know, and you could do that every day. I cannot go 15 feet outside and not hear something about wearing a mask or social distancing. You go to any major town, you are inundated with social cues, you know, wear a mask, do this, you know, on the radio, it's constantly put there, but with no additional effort. I mean, it doesn't require any additional advertising time. You could easily say, oh, and by the way, stop eating Doritos or give up Coca-Cola. We don't hear that. And why don't we hear that? Obviously, because the media companies are funded by these companies that, you know, want you to continue consuming their products, which is just, it's just a sad and it's so obvious. I don't know. It seems like you have to have voluntarily shut off part of your brain to not see that this is being ignored, you know, and incredibly so.
Yep, that's what the media is there for. I mean, it's just this constant drumbeat of noise and this constant gaslighting and shaping of reality according to what the sponsors dictate. And, you know, this is all ultimately, in my mind, tied in to the politics of fiat money. You know, it's not a coincidence to call it fiat food. It's not just fiat food because I'd like to insult it, not just because fiat is an insult. But these industrial things are, to a very large degree, fiat food because governments all over the world have spent the last century subsidizing those things and shoving them down their citizens' throats all over the world. You know, you look throughout the 20th century, food subsidies have been massively deployed by governments all over the world. And they weren't subsidizing ribeyes. They're subsidizing soy and they're subsidizing sugar and corn and all these large crops. And, you know, in terms of diet guidelines, this is a very important point. You look at how the U.S. diet guidelines have evolved. And, you know, they've basically set the tone for the entire planet, which takes, which marches according to the beat of American doctors and scientists. You see, American medical bodies and nutrition bodies have been, particularly since the 70s, recommending enormous quantities of junk because it's cheap. And I think, you know, in my next book, The Fiat Standard, I draw the connection between fiat money and fiat food. It's no coincidence. In the 1970s, you know, when inflation was taking off, one way in which Nixon tried to fight inflation was to subsidize the production of food and to make food cheaper so that to arrest inflation. Of course, the cause of the inflation was the printing of money. And so the way that they tried to understate inflation was to try and get people to switch away from expensive food. So there's all these stories about when the price of eggs went out. They started dwelling on the fact that cholesterol is bad for you and you shouldn't eat a lot of eggs because the price of eggs is going up. And then they will underweigh the eggs in the basket of goods. And the same thing happened with meat. And so, you know, well, you should stay away from meat. And, you know, you should get your protein from plants because that's much cheaper and that's easier to produce at scale. And of course, when you produce it at scale, it gets less nutritious. Of course, the other thing that happens is that you create an industry that is dependent on these government subsidies and then will lobby more and more for them. So, you know, initially it might have been, let's just subsidize those producers to make cheap corn and soy to make food cheap. But then you've created a massive industry that's worth billions that requires your subsidies and is going to continue to lobby for them and is going to continue to advertise for them and is going to continue to push all of the doctors and scientists that lead in this direction. And this is kind of the dead end of nutrition science for the past 40 years. You know, 40 years later, you still see those nutrition PhDs on Twitter. They're still telling you, you know, you should still get your 6-to-10 ratios or portions of grain. That's what the NHS website still puts there. 6-to-10 ratios of grain is really a prescription for diabetes, right? It's not something that a healthy person can handle.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the USDA, who develops our, you know, who we base our guidelines off, their committee develops that. I mean, a large part of what the USDA does is promote agriculture. I mean, that's their mission, and a lot of it is grain based. And that's what, you know, in the United States, that's what we have. This is what our one of our chief exports is you know, feeding the world grain. And this is, you know, there's just a huge financial conflict of interest in doing that, and then also coming out with a dietary guidelines, which, you know, over and over again is shown not to be evidence-based. It's basically, you know, interest-based, not evidence-based. And it's kind of the interests are to continue the status quo. And unfortunately, that's what we're left with, you know. And I've seen a couple of questions in the chat there that, you know, I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, Markita asking on the quality of meat, what do you think of that? So she's saying, as a burger from McDonald's isn't as good as a grass-fed prime rib. What do you think of that in terms of eating different types of meat? Are you very picky about the kind of meat that you eat?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'll go back to results. I mean, I always go back to results, and I think there's a couple ways to look at, you know, where you get your meat from. And I think there's a human health argument, there's ethical and environment arguments. And I think from an environmental standpoint, I think you can clearly make an argument that eating a regeneratively raised animal is better for the environment. And I constantly talk about that message, and I constantly try to get people to support, you know, ranches that do it that way. And then there's the human health side of things. And while there are nutritional differences between a animal that's finished on grass versus one that's finished on grain, we can point out and say this one has more vitamin E or omega-3 fatty acids and so on and so forth. The unfortunate part of that is that when you look at human results, there doesn't seem to be a big difference. In fact, there's been no difference that's been shown. There's very little data on there. Texas A&M University did a study about 10 years ago looking at this, looking at grass-finished versus grain-finished beef. And they looked at some biomarkers, which maybe are not the best outcome, but they looked at things like cholesterol and HDL, and I think triglycerides and blood pressure. And there was no real significant difference. In fact, the grain-finished beef was slightly better with when we're looking at those results. I surveyed something like 12,000 people doing the carnivore diet. And, you know, the percentage of people that got better eating grass-finished versus grain-finished, there was no difference with regard to coming off medications, diabetes. Like I mentioned, Harvard University is doing this study. And one of the questions I asked the researchers, please ask about the quality of meat you're eating, whether it's grass-finished, grain-finished, whether you're eating organ meats or not, to just so we know, because it's controversial within this community. And I've seen the results. I've seen the results on the study. It's not been published yet. But once again, it's going to show basically no difference. So I know it's nice to be able to say I'm eating grass-finished beef, and I think, mind you, not all grass-finished beef is actually better for the environment than grain-finished beef. It has to be grass-finished, but it has to be managed in a certain way where the animals are sort of holistically grazed and moved very frequently so that it supports the biodiversity and the soil sequestration of carbon. And so for some people, you know, if you tell people you can only eat this type of meat and do this diet, you're going to just financially exclude a whole lot of people that would otherwise attempt this. And so I tend not to you know, again, I tend to go where the results are. And I'm saying, look, this is a result. And it's just like, if you had wildly different results, then I would definitely let people know that. But so far, I haven't seen that. You know, maybe one day there'll be a study or enough studies that show that, you know, for certain conditions, grain finish is worse than grass finish, or vice versa, because it could be this, the other case. I've got people, now, it's not to say that certain individuals, I certainly have certain individuals say, I feel better when I eat grass finished meat. Now, maybe it's a placebo effect. Maybe they truly do feel better. I'm not going to dismiss what they say. So you just have to try it and see. But I mean, as a general recommendation, I tell people, if you like it, eat it. If you can afford it, eat it, go from there, and then you can make adjustments as you need.
Yeah, I think my honest opinion is that people coming from, you know, the standard American diet and the standard healthy diet, if you want, which is an enormous amount of conflicting information about what constitutes healthy. There's a significant amount of just an unhealthy relationship with food. And I think in the sense of people just worry about their food a little bit too much, which is probably understandable when you're eating plants and, you know, you probably do want to not eat the worst kind of plants and you want to process them properly and you want to prepare them properly in order to eat them. But it seems, looking at individuals and looking at the cases that I see in the Facebook groups of the carnivores, it seems pretty clear there's a very small number of people who can tell the difference. Like, there are a bunch of people that have some kind of immune conditions that say they will feel the difference if they eat grain fed, they won't feel as good. But it seems pretty clear that for the majority of people, you know, if the worst thing in your diet is the grains that your cow ate, then between, it seems like, the immune and digestive system of the cow and your immune and digestive system are able to take care of all the damage that's in there to an extent that is unmatched, even if you're eating the highest quality plant foods. I don't feel much of a difference if I go from grass-fed to grain-fed beef, but I feel an enormous difference if I go from any beef to even the, you know, the best organic, pristine, Bill Gates approved plants in the world. It doesn't matter what I do, you know, it's really the meat that makes the difference. And honestly, I think when it comes to, this is a deeply unpopular opinion, people like to virtue signal a lot about this, but I think The sad reality of it is first of all, before we get into that, like the majority of cows spend the majority of their lives grazing. So all cows that graze, very few cows are locked up for all their life. I don't think any, they won't grow healthy like that, right? They graze the majority of their life. The difference is the grain-fed cows are locked up for the last few weeks and months in order to fatten them up. Essentially, they're treated like modern-day citizens of democracies that get locked up to be fattened up whenever there's a virus. So I know it's not very nice, the treatment that they do for the cows, but you know, your responsibility is primarily for yourself. And I think the effects of not eating meat on a human being will cause more suffering to the human being than the cows in these pens. The humans can suffer much more from the deprivation of meat. And I think it's pretty rich for people who are malnourished to be worrying about the suffering of the cows, when I think, you know, a lot of your own problems come from your own malnourishment.
I've been on the feedlots with cows. I've walked around with the cows. And, you know, by law, at least in the United States, a single cow has to have something like 200 square feet of space, even within a feedlot. And so, and they don't even use that. So the cows aren't, they're not squished or locked in any way, shape, or form. And remember, they're herd animals. And the reason they cluster together is because, you know, if you go to the plains of Africa and see a bunch of wildebeest, they're all packed in together. And why do they do that? Because they're protecting themselves from predators. That's how they do it. They kind of cluster so they can all watch and see when a predator is coming. So it's not that they're packed in. I mean, they don't have a bad life. Even on a feedlot, it's not some horrible thing. Now, I'd say chickens, pigs, it's a different situation for them. And I would certainly agree that those animals could probably do much better. But the general, even a feedlot cow, it's not got a bad life at all relative to, you know, another ruminant animal. You know, there's a nice study at the University of Pennsylvania looking at white deer. You know, white deer, 50% of them don't reach it to 12 weeks of age. They are killed by a predator, ripped alive, you know, eaten while still alive. They'll either starve to death or freeze to death. That's 50% of them. A modern, you know, a cow that is raised in our domestic, you know, animal agriculture system has something like a 98% to 99% chance of making it to adulthood. You contrast that to a wild ruminant animal, they don't even, you know, like I said, most of the time, they don't reach to adulthood. And for those vegans out there, say, I speak for the animals. How many animals do you think would say, hey, I'd prefer to be ripped alive as a 6-week-old infant and eaten alive and, you know, die while my intestines are eating it out? Or would I like to reach to adulthood, be protected, sheltered, and fed every day? I don't know. If it was me, I'd probably maybe take my chances on being fed every day. But
yeah, know. Absolutely. I think a lot of people have their image of what animals are from Disney. I think I've heard you make this point before that, you know, in Disney, all the animals and all the species get together and sing and play, but that's not what life is like in the wild. In the wild, they rip each other up, and we give animals a much better life when we grow them for food. And, you know, they suffer for only less than a second when the stun gun hits them in the head and they die almost immediately. So their life has very, very, very little suffering, much less suffering than what would happen, I think, to an individual who is not eating meat. That's the way that I see it. All right. Anybody want to ask a question? We have a bunch of questions in the chat.
Yeah, I see.
Or
I see.
You get on, if you want to speak.
Yeah, I see like Peter's question about the environmental impact of the meat industry. Don Lehman did a nice study looking at the role of red meat in sort of diets. And basically the conclusion of that study was, a plant-based diet, if we went to an entirely plant-based system, we could probably produce about 20% more calories. However, that would result in significant nutritional deficiencies. We would have critical zinc deficiencies, lysine deficiencies. And so what you would have to do is people would have to eat more calories to get the same amount of nutrition. So what happens when people eat more calories to get the same amount of nutrition? They just get fatter. So, you know, we would have a fatter populace trying to get that. And we would have all these, you know, people that don't eat enough food would have nutrient deficiencies. And then the other thing is, and many people don't realize this, we talked about the healthcare system. If you want to make the argument about greenhouse gases and people are want to do that, you know, to save the world, the U.S. healthcare system is responsible for about 10% of our greenhouse gases in the United States. Right now, cows produce, and this is EPA data, cows produce 2% of our greenhouse gases. Healthcare system, 10%, cows, 2%. So that's a 500% difference. Interestingly, if every American all 330 million of us went vegan. And in addition, you would have to get rid of every cow, every horse, every pig, every sheep, every chicken, every cat, and every dog. And you made all those animals disappear. The net effect on world greenhouse gases emissions would be something like 0.3 to 0.4%. It is a basically ridiculously non-important number for every American to do that. And so this Meatless Monday, it's just a joke. It has no impact whatsoever on saving the planet. And so the environmental impacts are just ridiculously small. Now, what they'll do is they'll conflate these numbers to worldwide numbers, where we'll see something like 5% of our direct emissions are attributed to all of animal agriculture. That is because many countries, particularly third world countries, where they have no industry, they don't have cars, you know, significant transportation sector or an industry sector, all they have is animal agriculture. And so if we were to roll back the clock 150 years, probably 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions would have been animal agriculture. But no one would make the argument that the world was heating up and you know going through this catastrophic climate change. But we are making that argument now because we have this huge fossil fuel issue, which is a much bigger issue if you are trying to make a difference in that. So really, the sort of the vegan belief that the greatest single thing you can do is to eat a plant-based diet is just a bunch of garbage. It's just a bunch of smoke and mirrors and nonsense. And it, you know, me not eating a steak in California has nothing to do with environmental changes in, you know, Bangladesh. It has zero to do with that. It's just not even worth talking about.
Absolutely. And I think that what gets missed in this is that cattle and large animals, large ruminants in particular, are essential for healthy soil. This is how soil is depleted when you take away the animals. So if we took away the animals and, you know, we stopped farming all these animals and having all these animals graze everywhere, it's not going to be an idyllic Disney paradise of, deers and birds singing together with all the species. It's going to be dead desert, because these animals are essential because their feet till the ground and their feces fertilizes the ground. You take that away, you're left with desert. And I particularly like Alan Savory, who's done a lot of work on regenerative agriculture and reforesting by releasing large numbers of ruminants. So really, animal herding is key for healthy soil. And the idea that it's bad for the environment is just another one of these silly fiat sciences.
Well, I'll just add to that. You know, Alan Williams, who is another big name and has done a lot of research with regard to regenerative soil agriculture, has done calculations on, you know, U.S. grazing land, ranch land. And if something like 40% of the ranches switch to this regenerative style agriculture, and then those numbers are growing, it's, you know, 5, 7, 8% now. If you get to 40%, essentially, with carbon sequestration that the animals have been shown and proven to do, you can completely offset the entire carbon emissions of the entire United States, all industries combined, just by doing that. And so that is a solution. We've also seen that, you know, they're playing with feed additives. You know, they're using these algae-based feed additives to the animals, and they show they can completely shut down all methane production from cattle. I mean, something like 99% of the methane that they produce, which is the big concern, although it's real terms, it's not much of a concern, because methane is part of the natural carbon cycle that's been going on for, you know, 100 million years since ruminants started to first, you know, populate the planet. And so we've got this system that, you know, we've always had. You know, in the United States, we had anywhere between 30 and 90 million buffalo roaming the plains, plus all the elk and deer and bison and other animals that were there, far more than we have today. The U.S. cattle inventory is about 90 million cattle. You know, we had far more than that before without issue.
Yeah, before agriculture came to the Americas, I think it was 10 foot of topsoil on the American soil. But now with agriculture, essentially, most of the topsoil is depleted and you need to add fertilizers to have any kind of plants growing. Max is asking, what about long-term effects of the carnivore diet? 10, 15 years in, could there be long-term consequences? Have you seen anything or heard of anything?
Well, I mean, this is an impossible question to answer, you know, because I will tell you that there are no randomized controlled trials of any diet that's ever been done that can answer that question. So I tend to say this is a non-argument. This is astrology. This is, you know, reading the tea leaves. We're never going to know that for sure. What I will point out are there are traditional populations that have lived for millennia and lived, you know, 70, 80 years on basically carnivore diets. You can look at the Sami population, for instance, in northern Scandinavia, Finland, you know, some of the northern Russia. These people live on basically caribou meat, reindeer meat, and they actually, particularly the Sami, live longer and in greater health than their city-dwelling, you know, peers in Finland. And so we can say their average life expectancy is something like 82. So, you know, to say that, you know, this is a thing, you know, you can't come up with a critical argument because you look at people in front of you and saying, wow, they've lost weight. Wow, they've got off all their medications. Wow, they say they're really healthy. Well, now the next boogeyman is, well, in 20 years, you're going to die. Well, I don't know. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. You know, I mean, I know at some point I'm going to die. What am I going to die of? I don't know. Probably heart disease, because that's what most people die of. But to use that as an argument is, I mean, you probably have similar arguments about Bitcoin. Oh, one day a quantum computer is going to come by and just only disrupt Bitcoin. They won't go after the banking system. They won't go after, you know, the electricity grid. They're only going to attack Bitcoin with this quantum computer. It's a nonsense argument.
Exactly. And it's exactly the same thing that, you know, the same people that are concerned about what the carnivore diet is going to do to you 20 years from now, we're never concerned about what eating junk food was going to do to me 5 days or 5 years or 20 years from now. You know, as long as I was eating junk like everybody else, nobody was concerned about me. Now that I'm healthy eating meat, everyone is concerned. And similarly with Bitcoin, you know, all of the people worrying about quantum computing with Bitcoin don't seem to be worrying about what quantum computing is going to be doing to all of the essential infrastructure without which they would die. You know, like if you think Bitcoin is a problem, what's going to happen to the nuclear launch codes? And, you know, incidentally, Sean at some point in his career in the military was in charge of the nuclear launch codes. So if you're alive today, you are alive thanks to Sean's grace of not
I used to launch nuclear weapons, ICBMs for the Air Force, and that was something that, you know, and fortunately, one person cannot go renegade and launch things. So you have to have a cooperative effort and all the key codes and all that stuff. But yes, they used to trust me with that stuff. So maybe I wasn't totally crazy. Maybe they wouldn't today.
Yeah, but that was before the meat. Huh?
Before the carnivore, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So in all of your years of carnivory, have you come across any convincing argument of any particular plant that we need to eat? I've been a carnivore for 5.5 years. I've not found that I've missed anything. Do you think that there's anything there's any particular plant that's essential?
You know, I don't. I don't think, you know, I think, and again, I'll go back to this, the human colonization of Earth. If there would have been one plant that we have to have to survive, I would ask you, what is it? Where does it grow? Can you demonstrate that it grows in every part of the world and in all seasons? And if you can't find that, then the answer is no. And I don't think there's any plants that grow, you know, maybe grass. Maybe we need to eat grass. I don't know. But I mean, there's no plant that grows everywhere humans have spread. You know, we are the most widely diverse ranging species on the planet. The second most species that has had that diversity is a wolf. Wolves have occupied as much land, almost as much land as humans have. And, you know, again, wolves have very similar diets to what I think humans perhaps are designed to have. In fact, if you look at radioisotope data from, you know, Max Planck Institution, specifically Michael Richards' work, you know, the stable isotope of nitrogen and carbon signatures show that humans had a very carnivorous diet just as much as wolves. We actually ate more meat than wolves did back, you know, when these samples were taken 50,000 years ago. So I don't think there's a single plant that you have to have. I don't think fiber is necessary. I haven't had any fiber in 5 years. If it was a necessary nutrient, arguably I'd be dead, right? I mean, that's how I define necessary. Some people say conditionally beneficial, or and these are more nuanced arguments, but you know, the short answer is no, I don't believe there's a single plant that we must have to either survive or thrive.
All right, so we've got a couple of questions on fasting. What is your opinion on fasting? Do you think it's beneficial? And then there's a follow-up question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly can be beneficial for certain people. I think people that have very dysregulated appetites have been eating a standard American junk food diet for years, and their appetite and their satiety signals are so wildly screwed up because of the, you know, Moskowitz's bliss point, where he's kind of designed food that you can't stop eating and you never get satiated because you're never eating food of any high quality. Sometimes that sort of fasting schedule, whether it's, you know, going for 2 days or going 18 hours of fasting and 6 hours of eating window, that can be beneficial for people that need that. I think in general, the diet itself should drive your appetite schedule. You know, I can look at it. We can all go out in the wild and observe animals. None of them are wearing a stopwatch. None of them are having an app to tell them how to eat. None of them are walking around with Fitbit trackers, and they do just fine. And I think human beings, when given the food we're designed to eat, generally do pretty well. I mean, I often will eat once or twice a day. And it's not because I'm consciously trying to meet some fasting schedule. It's just when I'm hungry. And, you know, I find that, like, for instance, this morning I sat down, you know, just before I got here about 7 a.m., I had 4 pounds of steak, which sounds a little crazy for most people, but that may be my only meal today. You know, if I get particularly hungry later today, I'll eat again, but odds are I probably won't. And so I'm kind of what we call physiologically fasting. You know, technically, anytime you're not stuffing food in your mouth, you're fasting. It's just how long do you want to draw that line, whether it's 15 minutes or 15 hours is, you know, just kind of semantics at that point. And so I think there's benefits from not constantly stuffing food in your face. And I think that's what part of the snack food industry, the, you know, oh my God, when I was a child, I would come home from school and I would tell my mom, hey, I'm kind of hungry. And the answer back then was, well, wait till dinner because you're going to spoil your appetite. The answer today is, you know, here's a granola bar. Here's a little apple juice, you know, or something. And so we've got that mentality that the second you have the slightest bit of hunger, you've got to immediately slake that desire with some sort of cheap, highly refined, you know, junk food or some energy source, which is in the long term not going to do you good. So I think infrequent meals is probably beneficial. I think the diet itself should lend itself to that pattern, though.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that the way you like to think about it is that you prefer intermittent feasting to intermittent fasting.
Right, yeah.
I think that was what you said. And I think that makes sense. I think, you know, if you get hungry before you planned on having the next meal, then you didn't have enough meat in the meal that you had. So, but I'm wondering, do you find any particular preference for carnivores, long-term carnivores? Is it better to be eating one meal a day, two meals, three meals, or you think it's...
You know, I think that the pattern I see most common, you know, is a two meal a day pattern. I think that's what most people do, you know, because I think there's a certain amount of calories that you need to get in on a daily basis. And some people don't have the capacity to eat enough calories in one sitting. I mean, I fortunately can eat, you know, I can sit down and eat 4 pounds in one sitting, which a lot of people would struggle with. I do that pretty regularly and I don't have an issue with that. And so I can get, you know, I think what my caloric requirements are in one sitting, but most people do two meals a day. And I think, again, if we go back and we think about being a hunter-gatherer, if you will, but probably a hunter, a nomadic person that, you know, if you had to eat a meal every 3 hours, how problematic would that be? You know, you're walking through the woods to wherever you're going and you got to stop every 3 hours and set up camp and light a fire and cook some food. You know, that's unlikely to happen. You know, it's just, you don't have a microwave, you don't have pots and pans, you know? So I think, you know, it's probably humans very likely ate, you know, large meals in one setting and maybe only ate once a day and maybe twice a day. But, you know, you can certainly look at other populations. You know, there's historical accounts of, say, Mongolians. And for any people that don't realize that the Mongolian Empire was the largest empire that ever existed on Earth. And they lived on basically a carnivorous diet. And they were such good military operators that they could travel for, you know, 100 miles in a day and bring their food with them, bring their cattle with them, eat them, and just keep moving instead of, you know, where the Chinese, where they conquered, where they were eating a grain-based society, where they struggled to transport their food. And they were very, very dependent upon staying in one place all the time.
Yeah. So do you have any kind of guidelines for how much meat one should aim to eat, or do you think you should just go by what your body tells you?
Well, I mean, it depends on, you know, where you're at in this sort of journey. I think in the beginning, you know, when people transition to the diet, I tell people eat enough so that you don't want a cupcake, you know, and I think that's because that's dealing with these food addiction issues that people have. It's changing over to perhaps a more fat-based or non-carbohydrate-based metabolism. Beyond that, I mean, I think it's just as simple as, you know, one, are you hungry? If you're hungry, keep eating. And then look at your energy levels and your performance. You know, if you're struggling with, you know, cognition or the ability to function, then you're probably still under eating. And it's a very, I think the biggest probably issue that people have is they tend to under eat more than overeat. That's really, it's hard to overeat on the diet. It's not impossible, but it is challenging. And so people under eat initially, and then they end up sometimes symptomatic from just not getting enough food.
And what are your thoughts on fat and protein? Do you think you prefer to do this with high fat, high protein? What are your guidelines on it?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on goals. If I want to get just super, super lean, you know, and walk around with a six pack and just, you know, hey, take a picture and say, look at me, I'll tend to eat a little bit leaner. I think from a performance standpoint, there is a certain threshold amount of fat that you need. And I think that varies a little bit from person to person. For me personally, you know, protein around 35 to 40% is something. And that's closely matches the macronutrients of a ribeye steak, just incidentally, you know, if you look at that for, you know, by calorie comparison. So 65% fat by calorie, 35% calories of protein. That tends to work pretty well. If you're not getting any energy from carbohydrates, you need an energy source. And, you know, if you have a lot of body fat on you, then you can tap into that for a while. But once you get leaner, you need to have, you know, a decent amount of fat. You know, you don't have to go ketogenic macronutrient ratios where you're eating 80 or 90% of your fat, which some people like to do. And there's reasons for doing that, particularly for certain disease conditions. But I think for the average normally functioning person, a mix of about where I'm at seems to work pretty well. It's kind of interesting. There's a study on dog feeding where they self-select their relative fat and protein percentage. And interestingly, dogs will, you know, if they come from a sort of a nutrient deprived situation, they'll eat a higher fat diet initially, and then they'll gradually self-select a little bit leaner diet once they kind of reach, I guess, you know, nutrient sufficiency. So I think there's some degree where your body has a feedback system that says, okay, I've got enough fat soluble vitamins. Maybe I don't need to focus on that as well. And I think there's, you know, there'll be days when the fat is really appealing and there'll be other days when it's not. And I think you just kind of listen. I think, yeah, you know, if you're in tune with your body, it just makes sense.
That was my experience too. I used to prefer very fatty meat when I started, but now I like leaner meat. So I've shifted more toward porterhouse than ribeye over time. I still obviously love a ribeye, don't get me wrong. There was a follow-up question to the fasting. Nasser was asking, with Ramadan coming up, he plans to be fasting. He's asking, is there a problem or health risk when you do carnivore without water for long hours in the day? I don't know the effect that would have. Do you think there's a problem there?
Well, you know, it's interesting because and there's been a number of studies. Ramadan, there's a lot of published studies on Ramadan fasting, and this is a dry fasting because, you know, from sun up to sundown. Now, fortunately, it's in, you know, March, so you don't have as much daylight this year as compared to others when it's in July. I think that, you know, there is potentially, if you're eating a lot of protein, a greater requirement for water. So that could potentially be an issue. And so I think that this might be a time where you kind of skew more towards fat. You'll probably need a little less metabolic water, you know. And the reason I say that is because when you're processing a lot of protein, your body will take the nitrogen, you know, they'll deaminate the amino acids. And you have to, and then it converts into ammonia, and ammonia is then changed to urea by the liver very quickly. And then you have to get rid of that urea. And that often requires, you know, some fluid with that. In reality, it's probably not a big deal. I don't think you're going to be accumulating ammonia unless you've got underlying liver disease or something like that. So the reality answer is probably it's going to be of minimal impact. You know, if you wanted to hedge your bets a little bit, you might, you know, lean a little bit more on fat than protein during that time.
Fantastic. Thank you. This has really been extremely helpful. Anybody else have more questions? Oh, yeah. Peter's asking about coffee. What do you think of coffee, Sean?
You know, it's kind of funny. I've never been a coffee drinker. When I was a 14-year-old boy, I used to work as a dishwasher at a restaurant. You know, I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning to go wash dishes. And as a 14-year-old kid, you know, that's generally not something that 14-year-old kids like to do very much. But I just ended up doing that. And I remember I came into work one day and I looked particularly tired, and the chef or the cook said, "Here you go, kid." And he shoved a cup of coffee in my face. And I guess it was from the day before. I don't know. It just tasted awful to me. And I thought, how could people possibly drink this stuff? So I've never been, even when I was in my surgical residency working 115, 130 hours a week, you know, dead, I never got into coffee. Having said that, I think people that do a carnivore diet, many of them, you know, do coffee. I don't generally recommend cutting out coffee during a transition period. You may want to, if you're, like I said, if you're transitioning diet, maybe give it 3-6 months and then revisit whether or not coffee is something you want to keep or remove from the diet. I will say, of the people that do remove coffee, maybe slightly more than 50% of them say they feel better without the coffee. And so, and you know, why is that? Well, coffee can compete with mineral absorption. It obviously has appetite dysregulation effects. It can interfere with sleep, so on and so forth. The benefits, you know, it's a stimulant. You know, it may have some athletic advantages with regard to performance and heart rate. You know, you can perform at a higher intensity with a lower heart rate, so that may have benefits. But coffee, you know, caffeine, not just coffee, but caffeine, its function, the reason why plants express caffeine is it is a neurotoxin for insects. And that's why caffeine was invented by plants. So the fact that we find it nice and tasty in a drink is something. I like the smell of coffee. My girlfriend, who's French, drinks a lot of coffee, or at least, you know, a cup or two a day. And I like the way it smells, but I just don't personally enjoy it at all. But so I would say it's probably one of those things that's of minor importance, quite honestly. You know, it's not one of the big things, you know, I think you could do. I would rather see you go out and exercise and do a carnivore diet than just cut out coffee.
Yeah, I used to be a heavy coffee drinker, but on carnivore, I didn't even have to like plan on quitting it. It just went away. And now if I need coffee, if I have a long drive, I'll buy a coffee and I'll just smell it. And it does the job. I don't have to drink it.
That's another interesting thing, is that we see a lot of people that have different sort of addiction type issues, whether it's alcohol, coffee, drugs, smoking, find it much easier to quit when they go on a carnivore diet. And I think there's reasons they have to do with brain physiology and, you know, the different addiction physiology pathways that are occurring. But that is an interesting thing. So, yeah, but early on, I would say just leave the coffee in for now and then maybe later revisit.
One more drug question. AJ and Marquita are both asking, what about a good low time preference wine with a steak? What do you think of having wine with your steak?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I don't promote alcohol as a health food. I understand why people do it. I've got a French girlfriend, occasionally have a glass of red wine. Interestingly, saturated fat in both animal and human studies has been shown to mitigate the potentially damaging effects on the liver. So, you know, we know that ethanol has a potential, you know, we see that alcoholics have cirrhosis of the liver, and there's some pathways that allow that to occur, but saturated fat seems to minimize that effect. So if you're going to have a glass of wine, you should pair it with a nice steak. I mean, I think that's how you should look at that. So, and, you know, and obviously these are classic combinations. And so I'm not opposed to that, but if you're, an occasional glass of wine is obviously different than drinking 3 bottles a night every night for years. You're going to have a very different outcome.
Yeah. Well, Sean, thank you so much. Thank you for the time, and thank you for all the answers. I've settled all the questions that I had outstanding. I think a lot of my listeners will really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Can you tell us a little bit more about where people can find you online?
Sure. So I think the best place, again, like we mentioned, meetrx.com. In fact, I'm heading there in just a few minutes every day for 1 hour a day. I host a session for anybody who wants to come, so we can talk, you know, person to person. We'll sometimes turn that into a podcast. You know, like I said, right now I've got Mickey Bendor, and we're going to talk anthropology. My social media, you know, Sean Baker, 1967 is Instagram. So it's SHAWNBAKER 1967 on Instagram. Twitter, SBakerMD. And, you know, and I put up some stuff that just pisses a lot of people off, you know, from time to time, but it's controversial.
That's why we love you.
But I think, you know, you've got to encourage the conversation. And so far, I've managed not to get kicked off any of these things, but I'm always sort of in the back of my mind, at least a little concerned about that. Like I said, I want to, first of all, just thank the Bitcoin community for the warm welcome. You know, I think a couple of weeks ago said, hey, I'm all in on Bitcoin. I see the writing on the wall, and you know, it's pretty obvious where this is going. And so I hope I'm still early. I think I'm still early. I mean, I think most of you guys would, I think you guys understand. I think we're still early on this stuff.
And yeah, so absolutely.
I'm just, you know, gradually doing the hodling thing. And I think that's all I need to know. It's kind of, you know, like you said, it's a no-brainer, I suppose. And same thing with the diet. Just eat a bunch of meat. You know, I would add, do some exercise and get out in the sun and hold some Bitcoin and you'll be good.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right, Saif. Thanks, everybody, for joining. And I look forward to talking to you again, Saif. Okay?
Cheers. Thank you. Right. Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.